The American Constitution firmly separates church and state, yet religion lies at the heart of American politics. Just how this came to pass, how America became a nation with the soul of a church, is the subject of James Marone's new book, Hellfire Nation: The Politics of Sin in American History. Marone is a professor of political science at Brown University. Welcome, Jim.
Glad to be here. Great.
You write in your introduction that Hellfire Nation presents the American story as a moral tale or epic. What do you mean by that?
We usually tell the American story as a kind of secular tale. There's all this Enlightenment thought. The Constitution doesn't even mention God. Someone ran up to Alexander Hamilton and angrily said, "Why didn't you mention God?" And Hamilton is said to have said, very sarcastically, "We forgot." But political scientists and sometimes historians, when they picture America, often picture it as essentially a secular nation, and yet we are a nation with the soul of a church, very remarkably so. And so I wanted to tell the story of the United States through the lens of this very religious, very moral kind of people.
So why do morals play such a crucial role in America?
Partially, it's that we believe. Americans tend to be religious. I did a little session at the American Political Science Association meetings. There were about 200 American political scientists and five observers from England. And at some point in the middle of it, I said, "Okay, how many of you believe in God?" And about 180 people raised their hand. The English were shocked. They came up to me afterwards and said, "And it's such an educated group. How surprising." England and most Europeans' country went from religious to secular. We've gone essentially, I argue, from revival to revival. Why is that? Partially, I think it's the very separation of church and state. By keeping them separate, we've left no religion getting any particular advantage from the state. That means anybody with a better idea or a louder voice or a public airwave can come along and say, "Hey, join my religion." What that's meant is a very fervent, fertile kind of religious culture that just keeps on churning, keeps on changing, keeps on responding to people's needs. Because if you're in the religious business, you're always having to worry about keeping your faithful in your flock, because there could always be someone else coming along and winning them over to another way of thinking.
And you suggest that this has generated then moral fervor, but you write that that both stirs our better angels, as you put it, and also our worst demons. How do you explain that?
The demons part is what I really went in to look at. That's what I was expecting mainly to find. And that story I would summarize by that early image. Picture the Puritans coming ashore in 1630, even before, and suddenly facing this terrible existentialist crisis. Who are we? In England, it was easy, right? They were persecuted. You knew who a Puritan was because the government was coming after you. But here, very difficult. And they came up with that doozy of an explanation. We're the community of saints, the people preordained in our Calvinist universe to spend forever with God. Now, the saints are going to lead the community. They're going to vote. They're going to be the governors. Now, there's some people you're not so sure of. Well, they're the ones who have to follow the saints. And then there's the people you're pretty sure are preordained for damnation. You can tell who they are. They're poor. They're in ill health. And so they have to be cast out of the community. Hung as witches, slaughtered as Native Americans, sent off to Rhode Island as heretics, the Latrina of New England, they call Rhode Island. And that, I think, is the great metaphor for America and its politics. We, us, are saints. We're good people. And them, the people we don't think are very good, they have to be cast off. That's my kind of metaphor about the politics of moral fervor. It's always cast around us and them.
Okay, good. And you've already touched on one of the sections of the book, the first major section. And this is a huge book. I should tell our listeners, over 500 pages, so we can't begin to do justice to everything. Well, let's briefly touch on each section. You've already sort of touched on the Puritan section already. But in part two, you move into the 19th century, at least the first half, and you talk about religion and slavery. So why don't you address that as well?
I'll say one more thing about the Puritans, if I can sneak one
sure,
more line in. Not only that they have this existential problem, who are we? Deciding it with us and them. But they also had a fabulous idea. We will be a city on a hill, the eyes of all people upon us. So not only do we have to sort out who's us and who's them, but the whole world's watching. Now, in 1630, that was chutzpah of the most extreme variety, but they said it and they repeated it and they repeated it, and lo and behold, eventually it became true. I love the section on abolition, a whole great argument in American politics, because every side grabbed the Bible and said, the Bible explains our side. The pro-slavery people say, look, the Bible clearly sanctions slavery, and they point to their passages. Religion was very important in arguing for slavery. The abolitionists on their side also grabbed the Bible and said, no, the spirit of the Bible is clearly violated. And most important, African Americans, the slaves themselves, grabbed the Bible and said, Exodus is our story. The people of God caught in slavery under cruel Pharaoh, waiting to be redeemed, waiting to cross the River Jordan to the other side. So I love showing how the Bible and religion and moral argument really inspired every side.
Okay. In the third part of your book, you turn to the Victorians, competitors perhaps for the Puritans in many ways, in the image in the American mind. But you tell us about their quest for virtue. Tell us about that a bit.
This is my favorite section of the book. It's the Victorians after the Civil War decide that prime Puritan directive, control thyself, has been lost. And I trace a couple of great Victorian projects. One was a terror that white slavery was occurring, and I tell the story. This is a story of furtive immigrants sneaking on to the family farms, stealing white women, selling them into slavery in the cities. There wasn't any real white slavery going on in the way people feared it was, but there was such panic that President Taft said, we must do something. Congress rammed a law through, and it became illegal to cross state lines with an immoral purpose. And I play out how this fear of this other immigrants just at the era of great urbanization got played out as a moral fear that our women would be stolen. And the other story I tell in the same section is the story of Prohibition, this extraordinary effort coast to coast to keep Americans from sinning through drink. So one minute, good people in New York can drink as much as they want. A day later, it becomes illegal to sell a drink, and that becomes one of the great moral battles and one of the great Victorian efforts in American history.
Okay. Most of us associate the phrase social gospel with the late 19th century, but you really apply it beyond that into the New Deal, the Cold War, and even into the 1960s. We want to talk about that, but let's start by having you define social gospel.
When I first went into this book, this whole research project, I wanted to warn people against morality and politics. Here I was, a good researcher, and I thought, this is just trouble. And so I was trying to worry about Puritans. And lo and behold, I found there were lots of morals that were very different from what we normally associate with Puritans. And most dramatically is the idea that it's not individuals who, by their bad behavior, threaten the country, so much as the whole system that pushes individuals into tight corners. The social gospel is the word I pluck it out of historical context and use it for the idea that we have to worry about the whole community. Don't blame individuals, blame the system for pushing individuals into tough times. As Jane Addams said, are people poor because they drink? Maybe they drink because they're poor. The social gospelers are always saying, fix the system, worry about the economics, worry about racism, worry about the community, and the individuals will do just fine once we've done those kinds of reforms.
Can you apply it to the New Deal?
The New Deal is a great example. What happens? The first thing that Roosevelt watches is the demise of Prohibition. No more blaming individuals. Now we're going to start worrying about the system as a whole. So there's Roosevelt in his first speech on Social Security saying, look, this is like a disease epidemic. Poverty isn't an individual's problem. It's much more or more often the problem of a system that's broken. And morally, every religion tells us we've got to do something to help the poor. And that was a rhetoric. We've forgotten that, but it's a rhetoric he came back to again and again. We do it because it's right.
The Cold War?
The Cold War is very interesting because we continue the old Roosevelt effort to create a social security apparatus, a program for helping people. But now there's another moral politics, particularly the communists who snuck into our government. So you have a classic American witch hunt, worrying about individuals who are going to subvert the country, which draws the right into a highly moral fear, and at the same time, an extended social security program with the first stirrings of civil rights, both of which are social gospel. Cold War is wonderful because you get both Puritan and social gospel morality duking it out.
The 1960s.
The high tide of the social gospel. The idea that if you are underprivileged, maybe that explains your crime. And the great moment of the social gospel, the civil rights movement. The most brilliant social gospel preacher in American history, as I read it, was Martin Luther King. If you go back and read those beautiful speeches one after another, he didn't want to blame individuals for the problems they got into. He constantly focused on fixing the system and did so beautifully. So that's the high tide.
Okay. I love the title of the final section of your book, which you addressed the recent years in the United States, The Puritans Roar Again. Are they back?
Oh, they're back. Of course, with the recent election, you don't have to argue this too hard. People are beginning to see it. But if you go back and, say, read Time magazine from the 60s and early 70s, it's assumed that social problems are caused by social conditions. And then Ronald Reagan comes along. He was brilliant. He scorned that very idea. It's the individual. Don't blame anything but the individual. The individual could just say no. And he embraced the religious right that was just coming forward, just mobilizing. And at one point, he looked at them at their annual convention and said, because they were a not-profit organization, you can't endorse me, but I can endorse you. The brilliance of Ronald Reagan's rhetoric and of conservatives in the last 20 or 30 years is to completely bury the idea that we are responsible for our neighbors. The great parable that Martin Luther King emphasized at the end of his life, the Good Samaritan, is one you don't hear in public life anymore. In fact, we've almost gone so far as to say greed is good. That is, every individual for himself or herself. The notion of a social compact, social contract, social gospel, these have disappeared as the Puritans have roared back and said, bad people are to blame for our problems. And if you want evidence of that, go back to the latest election results and the polls around them and what the pundits are saying. It's as old as America, and that's what we're hearing all over again.
In 1 minute, you want to tell us what we learned from the last election?
I think if you had to summarize what's happened in American politics in the last 30 years, really, it's that the left has lost connection with its moral tradition, the tradition of the social gospel, and that the right has embraced with a fervor its moral tradition. I don't want to sit here on the radio and tell people, hey, you should be more religious, you should be morally minded. But I can say as a political historian that when the left has been most successful, it has had a moral fervor, powerful as anything as conservatives have today. So as I say, again, I think conservatives have found an old moral tradition. It goes right back to the Puritans. And the left is still lost trying to reengage with its moral tradition. So the assignment for this segment is simple. Go back and reread the speeches of Martin Luther King. And I think they'll reconnect, liberals at least, with the great powerful tradition, moral tradition that they have had. If you're conservative, you don't need any advice from me. You're doing fine.
Okay. Let's see if the Democrats do their homework on this one. Thanks, Jim, for being with
us. This is a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Our guest this week has been James Marone, the author of Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History, published by Yale University Press. This is Talking History.